Hey everyone, as you know, we are a bunch of ADHDers working together to create the most helpful ADHD content ever. And now it's time for the release of Everything at Once. This is the Everything Bundle, freaking for Christmas. And so we got so many good things to share with you. Addy, tell them about it.
So this month, for the whole of December, we're doing a Christmas sale, a holiday sale if you don't celebrate Christmas, and it's 90% off from our ultimate ADHD bundle. So with that, you get 33 products, which includes all of the ebooks, workbooks, Google Sheets, and Notion templates.
And they're
so
all very
pretty. It's pretty epic. Yeah.
They're all pretty and graphical. We commission artists to help make them, and they're glorious. For if you're visually minded, you just want to like look at them. They're so pretty. So I like that.
You can buy it for yourself for Christmas, or I don't know, for a friend if you think they have ADHD. And on top of the bundle itself, anyone who buys the product in December will go in the drawer to win this awesome prize pack. So in the prize pack, we have 10 free ADHD coaching sessions, which, you know, Lord knows we all need. We have $100 Amazon gift voucher times two and free access to all of our future books in 2024. So get in there, grab that bundle and get in the draw to win that awesome prize pack. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to ADHD Explorers. It's your host, Addy. We have a little bit of a change up today. Ben is not here, so it's just me. But not just me, we have our wonderful guest, Jessica Kellgren-Fozard. She is a disability advocate, a lesbian mom of the internet. We love her so much. Welcome, Jessica. And she also has a BSL interpreter with her, Ruth Ann. So if there's a little bit of a delay in Jessica's responses, that is why, because she's also deaf, in case you didn't know. So welcome, Jessica. Tell the community a bit about yourself.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I realize I just waved on a podcast. So hi to everyone there who is listening. So I am a YouTuber. I make videos on a whole range of different topics from disability, deafness, and LGBTQ plus awareness, generally with a kind of historical slant to them. I personally have two different genetic physical disabilities, one of which affects my nerves and one affects my connective tissues. And growing up, I wasn't aware that I actually had them until I was diagnosed at 17. So it was quite a fun growing up experience. And I also had undiagnosed ADHD because I didn't get diagnosed until I was in my 30s, which was largely because I found it very difficult to pull apart the symptoms that I was experiencing and think, isn't this just part of my overall body not working? Isn't this just part of things going wrong with me? Is this actually a condition in itself? I didn't have any idea until friends of mine who just have ADHD were like, oh, hon, no, this is absolutely ADHD. You need to get yourself checked. I was like, oh, yeah. Boy. And now I have found ways to make my life a bit easier. I'm like, gosh, if only I'd had this much earlier. And looking back, I'm certainly like, wow, wish I'd had this when I was a child. Wish I'd known.
Yeah, I have been watching your YouTube videos for a while. I don't know how exactly I got into it. I think it might have been either through like the disability lens or through like the queer. And then it just was like, you like both these things. And I remember watching one of your videos where you talked about memory and your struggles. And I was like, that sounds really familiar. Like the short-term memory and all of that.
Yeah, it's really difficult for me because part of being diagnosed at 17 was that I had to have a range of different diagnostic tests, one of which went quite wrong, and I got a little bit of just a smidge of brain damage from it. And I was then like, oh, I have this massive gap in my memory for like a year to 2 years really after this. And I really struggled very badly with brain fog, and I had to relearn to do a lot of things. And it was very difficult for me past that point to then say, what was I even like before? how did my brain work before that point? But the further I moved away from it, the more I came to the realization that, wait, I was never good at this to begin with. I could not do the long-term memory stuff when I was five. So I don't know why I was pinning it all down just to just this one event that had happened. Mm-hmm. Perhaps there was something else that was going on here as well.
Mm-hmm. So you just got diagnosed recently. Similar story, also late diagnosis club. How was that process for you? Like, how did you actually go about the diagnosis?
Yeah, my actual kind of, yes, you have this diagnosis was 2 years ago now, I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. Not that my memory's that great. But
we don't know dates.
Pathway to getting there took a lot of time because I tried to go I'm in the UK, so I tried to go the NHS route. And I just very recently actually remembered being a teenager and trying to talk to my family GP about how my brain didn't seem to function the way other people's brains mm-hmm. did. And he was like, no, it's fine. I'll write it down. But no. And I'm like, I'm really sure he did not write that down. He definitely didn't say anything. I'm like, great. Thanks, that man. Could have had that sorted when I was 14. Nope. So I tried
move to move for 20 years.
Route. Sorry. Oh, yeah. Took an extra, 20 years. Exactly. So I tried to go to the NHS route. And this was in the middle of the pandemic. So I think the pandemic brought up a lot of things for a lot of people, mm-hmm. right? You're like, goodness, mm-hmm. I could spend a lot of time sitting with my own thoughts. Suddenly comes the realization that my thoughts are very busy. It's a lot going on, and I don't have a lot to keep them occupied all of the time. I always try and explain, and I remember doing this to my parents when I was a child, attempting to explain my thought process and how my brain worked and why I couldn't go to sleep, because I couldn't sleep very well as a child. And they'd say, why can't you go to sleep? Why can't you just go to sleep? I didn't sleep for a full night until I was like 3 and a half, and a full night is 5 hours. They don't tell you that, by the way, when you first have a baby. They're like, yes, your baby will take a few months to sleep through a full night. A full night is 5 hours. It'll be 3 and a half years. And I tried to explain it to them growing up, this feeling of what was going on in my brain. And I was like, parents, it's as if I have 10 TVs on in front of me, and they've all got different TV channels on, and there are 5 different radios playing, and I'm also reading these 6 different books and 3
one part of a song on a loop
conversation with me, and I'm also trying to write different notes for different things, and I'm also running on a treadmill, and I'm also there's something over there that's also flashing, and what on earth is that? Oh, I bet I can't see what that is. Goodness me. And that's just constantly going on whilst I'm lying here trying to get to sleep. So no, of course I can't just switch off, calm down, go to sleep. And yes, I'm not the typical running around the classroom type, that everyone thought you needed to be in the 90s. But I think like some of those struggles should definitely have given it away. But yeah, so then when I did eventually, I was like, I should really, I'm going to have to take this to someone else. I had a friend who had gone to a private doctor for her ADHD, because she'd sat on the NHS waiting list and was like, it's not happening. And she gave me the name of her doctor. And I sent out an email to him, but also to like 10 other private doctors. And I didn't get any emails back from the other doctors But her one sent me an email back saying, well, I'm just retiring. Here's the name of someone else who's quite nice. I was like, oh, okay, thanks. And that, yes, another email, but that was the one person who emailed me back. So go that doctor. And she was lovely. She was really great. So my doctor was very, very nice. And I had the amazingly validating experience of going through an ADHD assessment in which my doctor was like, that type of thing is generally hard for people with ADHD. I was like, oh, yeah. It was hard actually. Yeah. Mm. And she was like, it's a very good job that you managed to complete that higher education, because most people struggle to do that. Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, it did take me 5 years when the course was only 3. She's like, but you finished it. And that's what really matters. And I was like, oh, you're the best doctor I've ever met. Oh my gosh. So yeah, deep love from the back. Just from that one assessment. But yeah, it was a wonderfully validating experience just to have that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Have someone say, and then at the end of that go, yes, this quite clearly is something you have.
Yeah, I also got diagnosed with STADA last year, so almost 2 years ago as well. And I initially started to try to go through the NHS when I lived in the UK. Went to a psychiatrist. He was like, it's probably childhood trauma. Don't worry. It's just your brain's messed up from all the stuff that happened to you. And then he was like, we'll put you forward for a specialist. And I was like, well, I'm moving to Canada in 6 weeks. So lo and behold, 6 months later, I got forwarded the referral letter from my old housemate and was like, well, this isn't going to happen. Then the panty hit and, you know, messed things up. And then I procrastinated getting diagnosed, but finally last year, after another year's wait between initial assessment and actual seeing a specialist. And then yes, that validation is it's something that's like, oh, I'm not broken, you know.
I think the thing is, you can have something and something else. Like, it is completely possible. As someone with two genetic things that came from, like, either side, I actually have one genetic disability from each parent, which is
fun.
Incredible. Like, what luck. Saw each other across a bar and were like, I see you. I see you. They didn't know, either of them. They just, you know, wild, straight people procreating and created me. And it's completely possible to experience something and also experience something else and have a kind of blurred line between them, and that create another level of difficulty in and of itself. I have multiple things where I'm like, I don't know whether what my fingers are feeling today is pain because of my nerves or pain because of my connective tissue. And I have to treat them differently depending on what is actually the root of this pain. Like, how do I solve this? I do not know. I don't know what's causing it. I don't know what to do to help it. But having something like someone say, well, have you considered that the brain fog that you're struggling with might be because of ADHD rather than just might be because you're in pain, which is never going to be fixed. So, oh, well, let's just live with it. But instead, actually, there might be some things we could do. Like, there might be some workarounds, some life tips. There might even be some medication you can take. Was really freeing to be like, oh, wow, great. Excellent. Wow. The one I can do something about.
Yeah. So I guess on that note, a lot of people, from what I've heard, have this overlap of things like EDS, connective tissue, and ADHD. For some reason, the neurodivergent EDS like overlap is massive. So how do you find that those things interact with each other?
Yeah. I mean, I had a doctor say to me once, and like, don't quote this as any kind of medical advice or the evidence or whatever, but
not a doctor.
I had a doctor say to me once, if something's going to go wrong with your brain and you have connective tissue, it's going to be ADHD. So because your brain is like, if you think about it, like there's a lot of, as it's growing and forming and developing, if it doesn't have the strongest building materials to be holding those structures in place, it's going to be finding its own workaround ways to develop. And that is highly likely going to lead to things that we would call a neurodivergence. So, yeah, I mean, that makes sense to my mind. If that's how your brain is forming, then yeah. So I do see a massive, there's a very large overlap in this community, yes. And there's a lot of research that's been done on it, is still being done on it, is to be done on it. But in terms of things like how do we find and recognize what is X and what is Y and what do we actually do about it? I think sometimes the only thing to do, and oh God, this is so corny.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. But is to first of all take that step back and take a moment to be like, I have to approach this from a moment of kindness for myself. Okay, like, does my body, first of all, need something? Because I know if my body is physically at a depleted point, there obviously isn't going to be anything my brain can't make up that make up for slack. Is that even a saying? Sure. Yeah, we'll go with that. That if I'm, you know, my health is a bit tenuous. My ability to stay healthy is hard work. It's not something that I can take very lightly. I can't have multiple late nights, and I can't I can't have a lot of fun. So I can't just be like, yeah, sure, whatever, I'll totally do that. Yeah, like I get offered a lot of opportunities through work that I'm like, oh my gosh, yes, amazing, would love to do that, absolutely. Oh, I can't though, because I already have one late-ish night that evening. And a late-ish night is like, right now I'm talking to you and it's 7:30 p.m. Welcome to my late night. Hi.
Yeah, which I appreciate.
You're welcome. But the point is that it's just having to keep my body and my brain in a very good state and making sure that I've been fed and watered and rested and everything, even more than most people have to do, and knowing that I can't really cheat. I don't get to skip a meal and not be punished severely by my body for it. Which then comes on with the knock-on effects of things like a little brain fog and really struggling with things that are similar to some of my ADHD symptoms. So sometimes I can be like, is my ADHD really bad today? Or did I just not eat enough?
Did I not eat?
Like, And so sometimes I do, it is genuinely that I have to think, like, were there enough calories in my last meal? Was it calorific enough for me to feel okay? Because I don't necessarily register hunger in the same way. And I know a lot of people with ADHD, we forget to eat. If I'm left to my own devices, I know food? No, absolutely not. Not doing that. Not taking time away from my day of doing whatever, getting sucked into something. So I need to have the reminders to eat, and I need to have the reminders to eat enough, and that it needs to be filling and wholesome and so on and so forth, or else I'm out for the count. But then if I am like, okay, good, right, I know that I've done that, then it's also the level of, wait, when am I in my menstrual cycle? Because, you know, because that's going to hit you too. And why is ADHD affected by that?
They don't tell you that you might need to, like, increase your meds when you're on your period. Like, doctors don't tell us that.
No. Like, I'm sorry, why is this? Why? Is it because, is it water retention? Did I just make that up? But is it because we're suddenly like, oh, meds are just less effective now?
Mm.
Although, do my pain meds work less when I have my period? I don't think so.
No.
I take a lot of medication.
Maybe it's something to do with, like, hormones and because it's neurotransmitters.
True.
Mm.
Hormones, though, just messing everyone up all the time for no...
All the time.
Just don't need that. Don't need that.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that when you are doing those things to take better care of yourself, like eating and trying to sleep and drinking water, that then not only is your ADHD better, but then potentially some of your physical health issues are a bit better as well?
It's kind of a tricky thing to say, like, are my physical health symptoms better? Because it's more that they are just manageable. Like, they are just at an even keel. Like, they're at an even level. So sometimes I will see family members who I haven't seen since I hadn't learned to manage my body. So when I was 17 and got diagnosed, it was because I had this big kind of health crisis, and I went through a long time of not knowing really how to manage my body and how to manage my my symptoms and my disabilities and to really make my body be its most effective, I guess is the word. And then when I met Claudia, my wife, 9.5 years ago. My gosh, 9.5 years ago. Wow.
Wow.
A really long time. Was the one who really helped me put in place, like, okay, we're going to take you to this doctor, this doctor, this doctor, and this doctor, and they are going to sort out your stuff. And I was like, oh, okay.
Oh,
great, thanks. She comes from a medical background. So she was like, this is ridiculous. No, you should be seen by people. I was like, okay. All right, darling, if you say so. And she, like, took me places and they listened to her because she's got a very authoritative voice and she says Latin words sometimes. I was like, oh, this is wonderful. And she got me on, like, the best medication regimen for me and worked just, like, got everything sorted as to where I'm now in, like, a management state. So when I see family members now, he'll say, wow, my goodness, you're so much better. Are you better now? And I'm like, no.
It's never going away. I just learned how to deal with it.
I'm in pain every day. but I just know how to live now. Like, I know how to deal, how to manage it. Whereas when you saw me, I was, like, wildly out of control, unmanaged, had no idea what I was doing. So I think keeping that regimen with it helps me in a variety of ways. And I know people with ADHD respond. So all the people I know with ADHD fall into two camps. One of them that's like, I need structure. I need to timetable my life. Like, I have to get up at this time. I have to finish at this time. It must be like this, this, and this. And that's me. I'm the Google Calendar type. Like, I have to have the color-coded Google Calendar. I think having a toddler has been an absolute blessing for me because it has to happen at this time. Mm-hmm. We must wake up at this time. We must sleep at this time. We must mm-hmm. eat at this time. This is just what we do. And I'm like, okay, good. Yeah. No, this is great. Love it. Okay. I can do that. And then you get the other camp of people who are very much into the more like, if I just go with my flow, I'm going to be the most productive me. And that is how I work the best. Mm-hmm. And that could never be me, because I'm like, well, I could try waiting for the flow to come, but I will have been distracted by something else before the flow comes. Or even when it comes, mm-hmm. I'll be busy playing The Sims for the 8th hour in a row. So I need to, I'm afraid I need to schedule this day.
I love that. I don't know why that's so gay to me, like playing The Sims. I think it's just because in my childhood, it was like
our lesbian families. I mean, not everyone's families in The Sims are lesbians.
Just a lesbian.
The towns are all lesbians.
So I congrats on 1 million. I just checked. I saw your video a few weeks ago that was like, we're almost there. And then I checked your page this morning and I was like, do you find that having subscriber count goals helpful, or do you strive for other things when you are making your YouTube and other content?
I definitely never have subscriber count goals in a sort of mm-hmm. meaningful way. It's not something that I measure success against. Mm-hmm. Because my subscribers on YouTube, my subscriber goals and success on YouTube was a little bit wild. In mm-hmm. that I think 1 year, I was like, I said at the start of the year, my goal this year is to get to 20,000 subscribers. And by the end of the year, in October, I think I was at 18. So I was like, oh, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Yay. We'll get there, maybe. And then by the end of that week, I'd actually hit 100,000. And then the next week, it was 200,000. And then by the end of the year, it was 250,000. So I was like, oh, wow, goodness. All right, well, anything is possible. So it's very much, I don't, it's not a metric that I'm like, yes, this is the hard and fast. Absolutely mm-hmm. means something. For me, I think it's more about creating content that my audience wants to see, like that they find interesting and that they find engaging and mm-hmm. want to come back for more of. I think subscriptions are more about sort of saying like, oh, I'd like to come back for more of this. But yeah. I also want to make videos that people maybe don't want to come back for more of. Wait, that sounds terrible. But the ones that you kind of send to somebody to say like, dear, you know, grandparent, parent, so-and-so, uncle, aunt, friend, I would like you to understand more about this topic. I would like you to understand mm-hmm. more about this phrase that you used or this way of being and mm-hmm. how you may have incorrectly used it or... Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Maybe you said something that's a little bit off key there. Ooh, so here's a video that will hopefully explain to you what I mean, and I don't have to have an argument with you. In which case, I'm like, I'm not really expecting those people to subscribe, and that's totally fine.
Actually, I had that experience, I guess, recently with one of your videos. You're around Halloween time. You did something about, please don't go as like scarred and disfigured. And I went as Freddy Krueger for Halloween. And I had a moment of like, Adamina, she's right. Like, why am I doing this? Why am I wearing? And like, it's this, he's a character, right? And I'm not going intentionally as someone who's disfigured just for the sake of being someone who's disfigured. But then I was like, wow, this is really like actually made me think about something. So I really appreciate that you like bring topics like that to light in a way that you're like, oh yeah, I hadn't thought about that being an issue.
Yeah, I think that it's often my videos can be about bringing up issues and sort of saying to people, have you considered this? Like, maybe we should talk about this some more. Like, here are some words that we use in casual, everyday, today language that are actually really ableist. And we've just not considered it before. And not considered the ways in which they may seem harmful to people. Down low, I was always hurt by them as a child. So let's talk about those kind of things.
Yeah, that's I love that. And it's something about your content and a lot of the other, like Molly Burke, other disabled YouTubers, that I have learned so much about the disability space through like your content and other people's content. And it's made me realize there's just so much that's going on in the world that we don't realize is maybe not the best.
Well, we can never know what everyone else is going through. We can never know everyone else's perspectives on the world and what their first person experiences are, but it's just important that we're able to listen and be aware, be willing to understand. I mean, I really love that about the internet. I think I come across so many people who, I mean, so many, not to malign everyone, but so many particularly older parents who have a bit of a fear of the internet and how their children use the internet, and isn't it all bad, and isn't everything about it terrible, and are there any actually good parts of it? And I'm like, well, no, because the internet can be such an amazing, wonderful, powerful place, not just for, yes, we have all of this education that is now available to us, but we also have, you know, first-person perspectives that were previously not shared. We're able to learn more about ourselves in the same way that, I mean, people now are able to go, wait, is this actually an ADHD thing? Oh my God, oh, it is? Wait, I've always done this. No, is it really? Oh, I see. That's me. Constantly, I'm like, I see now why I do this. And then you also get this thing where you're able to build a sense of community with people who you, without the internet, would never come across.
Yes.
You know, you're living in a small town, and where else are you going to find the other queer disabled? You're like, oh, it's just it's just me. Cool, great. I mean, I was there.
And that's something
in secondary school.
Yeah, we I think strive to do that through ADHDers, right? Is like create this sense of community. And it's so important. Like having people, some of the responses we get to like the podcast or posts is like, oh wow, I always felt like I was the only one. Or I never knew that other people did that. And like it's so validating to see that. Like everyone goes through this. At least this is a normal experience for ADHDers, and it's like just giving people that is so like heartwarming.
Yes, it is. It really is. And I think particularly when it comes to things like parenting, it is really wonderful to be able to talk or even see things from other parents who have similar experiences. And are able to be like, yeah, no, same. I also feel like when I'm with my child is the only thing in the room, which is my experience. Whenever I'm with him, I'm like, it's just him. I can't do anything else. Sorry, world. Which it's really great in some respects. Really great. Not great in that, like, he is 2.5. And I should probably learn how to like clear the breakfast table whilst also playing with him. Like, fortunately, we do Montessori him. So he has to, so he does a lot of stuff. So I can be like, this is involving him. But if he doesn't, if he's like, I'm not into that this morning, I'm like, oh, okay, never mind. Let's go to a sticker book. And then my wife walks in like, sorry, was it not your job to clear the breakfast table? Yeah. But then there was a sticker book. She's like, not for you. The sticker book's not for you. It was a princess sticker book. Who could turn that down? It's less sparkly stickers. God.
Yeah.
I mean, I think
how cool. How do you find that your ADHD affects your parenting?
Well, we it's probably started, I would say, before birth, in that we got deeply obsessed with styles of parenting. I've kind of always been interested in, I didn't know it was Montessori, but interested in the very respectful parenting style. And before Rupert was born, I read a lot of books about Montessori parenting and respectful parenting in an ADHD way. So I own 50 books on the topic, I'm going to say.
Just a slight hyperfocus.
If anyone would like to borrow some, you know where to go. I've got a library now. It's great. It's quite comprehensive. It's deep. Yeah. So very much into it in that sense. I have a lot of quite like repetitive things with him when he was a baby. We like printed out schedule sheets and stuck them to the fridge because I was really worried that I would forget how to do things. I find it really hard to, unless I do a physical motion every day or very frequently, I will forget how to do it. So I curl my hair a lot, for example, in vintage rollers. But if I change the curl pattern of my hair and I do it 3 times in a row, I can't remember how to do the way I did it before, even if I did it for a year. So, which is like, wow, well done. Amazing brain. Great. It just does not lay down for me. That track just does not stick. Fortunately, though, I do make YouTube videos about curling hair. So I sometimes do go back and watch own YouTube videos about hair curling to try and remember how I curled my own hair previously. Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. So I used to print off these sheets about baby-related things that had to do with each stage of his life, whatever we were in that stage right now. And they would get stuck to the fridge. They would be above his changing table. All of these things that were very like, this is really important. I really need to do this. My God, what if I forget? Oh, I'm so worried about it. Oh, dear. And as long as I followed them, I was okay. We'd get rid of one and then I'd stick the next one in the fridge and I completely have forgotten the previous one. But it was okay. And that big focus on him has remained the whole time, where I'm very much like, he gets a lot of my focus and a lot of my attention, but I can't look at anything else. So I can't look at my phone when I'm with him, which freaks my wife out, because she's like, I was messaging you to check you were okay. You didn't reply. I'm like, well, you knew I was with him because I didn't reply. So if I didn't reply, I was obviously with him. She's like, or you could be in a ditch. So many options. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's very fair. Yeah.
But it means, I guess, you're a more present parent in that sense, that you're like, just he is your main focus, which is amazing.
Yes, it does. I definitely have is it an issue? I don't know if it's an issue, because to my mind, it's great. But I am very invested in his like educational interests. So I tend to purchase a lot of things and make him things. And I'm like, what is the next brain stimulating thing I could do with him? What would he like to do next? What is the next crafting project we could do? Ooh. And I think that some people around me are like, could you do some work maybe in the next hour? And I'm like, no, I am busy cutting out this bumblebee. It's very important. He needs to stick 20 bumblebees onto this hive. It's his sticking practice. And I'm like, oh my God. It's got I'm very involved.
I watched one of your videos recently where you're talking about your ADHD, and in it you said, I don't get bored because of all the thoughts in my head. Do you never find yourself understimulated?
Oh yeah, I guess that's also another thing about parenting. Is that when he was really little, there are lots of kind of repetitive motions and things you have to do. And you have to be like rocking the baby. We just have to like walk the baby around so they'll go for a nap. But I just did that as my wife would do it. Like, oh my God, you've got to walk them around so they'll go for a nap. And I'm like, you just walk them around so they go for a nap. Because I'm fine. I just walk them around and I think one of my thoughts. Because my brain's just full of them. No, left to my own devices, I feel sometimes like my thoughts are just constantly streaming past me. And I can pick one of the threads and pluck them and listen. Oh, this is weird. This is gone. I've lost this. But you know what I mean? When they're all going
on. Yeah.
It's like they're all like, moving at the speed of light.
And then follow like, that.
Pluck a thought out. There we go. Oh, exciting. Yeah. Oh, that one was interesting. Wow, what a story. Oh, fascinating. That was an interesting memory. Oh, that's generally what's going on in my brain. So I'm never at a moment where I'm like, oh, I have an empty head. I guess if I feel an outside understimulation, it's never internal. It is also, I would just like to say, an amazing coping method for incredible pain. Part of my physical stuff is that I sometimes have to deal with really, really bad pain, like really quite bad. And I just go to a little place in my head and look at my thoughts for a while. I'm like, sit by the stream of thoughts, think about them. And I'm quite good at just stepping back. But I think I did that a lot as a child. And I'm very good at just being like, I guess this classroom is not that interesting to me today. What else have we got to think about? Well, these things. Oh. Fantastic.
So you fall more into the like daydreamer type ADHD, I suppose.
Yeah, a hyperactive mind for sure. I don't know. I mean, maybe my body would be hyperactive if it had the energy. I definitely would like to move more. I used to dream about running. I used to daydream about being able to run and move and jump and climb and do those things like I desperately wanted to be able to. But I was like, the second I move, I'm going to dislocate something and fall apart. I have learned my lessons. I will sit. I think I learned from about the age of 4 not to move much. So...
Do you find that you need to do things with your hands or stim in other ways?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, I'm currently doing that. Yeah. I definitely have to do something. I don't really understand people who can sit and watch TV and just watch TV. How bizarre. What a concept. The television is only one thing. It's just one thing happening. It's one input. What's your output? What's going on? Yeah. But this works out so well in my wife's favor, I have to say, because my chosen way to relieve this is to rub my wife's feet, because it's incredibly satisfying. For anyone else who has ADHD and struggles with what do I do while watching TV, rubbing someone's feet is really satisfying, because their feet get less tense as you rub them. So you really feel a sense of completion as well.
It's like a stress ball.
Like, oh, I did it. Go me.
And nice for them.
And, funding, it makes her feel good. Releases, I'm sure, some nice hormones in you as well.
Do you find that when you're signing more, that also gives some kind of an output?
Yeah. So people do ask me about this, and it is a kind of yes and no question. So sign language isn't it's a language. It's not a. I think if I were to do it, I can't just pick the fun words that are flashy and give you the optimum feeling of yay, I have.
You're just saying welcome, welcome, welcome.
You know what I mean? Yeah. You can't just be there hi. because you're not really saying much. I do find at home when we're signing a lot more, it is helpful, and it does lessen things a bit, but it isn't a comparison for when you're just kind of standing there and flicking your hands around to get the feeling out.
I have been learning ASL, and so I find that sometimes when I'm at home, it is it's the same as, I guess, when you say a word, it's called echolalia, when you repeat words, and sometimes I do that out loud, and so I guess it's the same kind of thing where I'm just Turtle.
Wait, do that. Turtle.
Turtle is, what is it again? It's like a shell with the head coming out.
Yeah, no, I can see excited. A tiny bit of you as well, so I was
excited is a nice one, because it so gets that same,
We have the same turtle? No.
I think, there's I looked it up. There's 30-something% cognate signs between BSL and ASL. So the same. And then I think, I can't remember.
Not except for the alphabet.
There's more than you.
I will never be able to understand the ASL alphabet. Ever. those videos, oh my goodness. So obviously Instagram is you're deaf, and it serves me sign language videos a lot, but it has no clue about different languages. So it's constantly giving me videos with ASL. And quite often I'm just like, whoa, what even? Because my brain's trying to go, what? Wait, I got what? That one I got. No, what? No, what? What? No. Because they're just signing so quickly. Generally in finger spelling. It's how do their fingers, what, not even. I cannot spell, so I think that doesn't help at all. Because even in BSL, I'm like, let's take this spelling slow. What do these?
Yes, I tried to learn Jessica. And it's my brain is two hands for Whereas I'd be like Jessica in ASL. I can do my name a lot faster. One hand, it's one hand.
Wait, yeah, because with ASL, I know that you just do like a little flick for J. So much easier.
Yeah.
Wow, this is riveting podcast conversation, by the way.
Yeah. anywho, I guess we can get onto some of the listener questions. Yeah. Someone asked, I like this one. They were like, how would you recommend everyday retail workers make their workplace more accessible for disabled customers? I can't change corporate policy or the inaccessible architecture of my store, but is there anything I can do as a personal worker?
Well, I think since we were just talking about sign language, I think knowing a few signs is a really good way to start. Very basic things like, can I help? Are you okay? That type of thing. Maybe you obviously don't want to, I mean, you're not going to give the impression of, I think people worry about, is that like, oh my gosh, if I learn a tiny bit of sign language and then I go up to a deaf person and I sign, can I help? They're immediately going to think I know everything about sign, and they will start signing at me really quickly. And I'll be like, oh my goodness, nothing. It's not going to happen. It's okay. No, I really don't think a deaf person is going to be like, wow, you obviously know all of the signs, much like in another language when you go up and like, I actually don't know how to say can I help in another language, in French, however you say it in French, a French person's not going to be like, well, let me give you a long spiel about exactly what I'm looking for in this shop, please help me find it. Excellent. But a few basic signs are always helpful, and I actually think they're really helpful for everyone, not just people who work in a public facing business, because it is, you know, a lot of people in our country use sign language, and also hello, this is, well, I mean, obviously with this podcast probably being listened to by people all around the world, but I live in England. And in England, our languages are English and BSL. So get to know BSL. And you can help a person even if you see them on the street. You don't know what they what they might need. Or just make a friend. That's always nice. Other than that, what can you do to be more accessible? I think approach every interaction with kindness. I know, I'm so sorry, that sucks probably as advice to give someone who works in any kind of retail, because you're like, oh, really? I try. The public can be a lot of fun. My wife was a dentist, so she's certainly dealt with people being incredibly rude to her a lot. But just kind of, there is a lot of assumptions that are made about people with the implication that they may be acting in a way because they are perhaps that is due to their character rather than due to an invisible disability. And we can't know everybody's backstory. We can't know where they are at their place in the world right now, and we can't know what's going on for them, especially in really overstimulating environments like shops. A shop can be just an incredibly busy, overstimulating environment, right? Like, you need, sometimes you just need a minute, you're not your best self. So just allowing people the grace to, you know, not to be outwardly rude to you, but just to take that moment, take a step, and just maybe look a little bit out of character. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. While we're talking about stores, I guess it's appropriate. What are your thoughts on the influence of being neurodivergent / disabled on fashion choices? And what are some recommendations of accommodating garments for hypersensitivities?
Oh, okay. So that's a really interesting question. I think obviously it is a case by case basis. We all have different things that we find pleasing or not. For me personally, I have to have something tight on my waist, and I have to. I know most people are like, "What? No." I have to have something tight on my waist and on my chest ribs, but I cannot cope with any kind of trouser related article. and I'm like, oh god, no.
I watched a video where you wore jeans and I was just
yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I didn't wear those jeans all day because I couldn't. I can't anything. Oh, behind your knees. Behind your knees. Who, why are people okay with that? It's absolutely unconscionable. No, for me personally, and I can only speak to other people who might be like me, I really enjoy wearing 1950s styled dresses because they work. I mean, it's not the only reason they're so great, but one of the reasons that I really enjoy wearing them is because they work so well for how my body likes to feel. It really likes to feel quite crushed around the middle. And then I like to not feel tight on my hips and thighs. And, you know, it's really freeing wearing a massive skirt. Mm. It's incredibly freeing, I have to say. But in terms of petticoats, I can only wear those, like, really expensive chiffon ones, because it's really annoying. That one's a scratchy and I can't cope.
Oh yeah,
with even the minor level of irritation, I can't cope with that. It has to be the softest thing possible. And all winter long, I wear ballet dancer tights, 100% every time. Generally in a cream and ivory. If anyone else wants to take that tip, you're welcome. But just so you know, you don't have to wear trousers. Don't believe the hype. Cold weather doesn't mean you have to stop wearing your skirts. No.
Yeah. So taking what your body wants as, I guess, a guide towards your style, maybe?
Yes, absolutely. Also, having a large petticoat and skirt provides you with an excellent cushion for if you fall over, which I do a lot. So that's great.
And related to that, someone asked how to make a capsule wardrobe or build your personal style, but the ADHD version, because shit happens and impulse shopping is inevitable.
Yeah, no, absolutely, completely understand that one. I try not to buy anything for myself, and it was going really well, and I had a baby, and he just keeps growing, and he just needs clothes, just needs them, just have to get them, just have to. What a shame. Oh no. So I tried to limit myself to these boxes. I bought these boxes from IKEA, and I put like 0 to 3 months on them, 3 to 6 months, and like 6 to 9 months, 9 to 12 months on them. And I was like, if it doesn't fit in the box, we don't need it. Like, he just has this box for that age group. That will be it. That's fine. Which is one of the advice things that you're given for how to start a capsule wardrobe. That does not work with a baby. That's not how they grow. They don't grow like half a centimeter at a week. An absolutely rubbish idea.
Exactly.
They grow very quickly at the start and then they just stop for months. And I was like, oh dear, no. Right, well, this is a terrible idea. Okay. So he's got a lot of clothes in like certain size ranges and not the others. That didn't work at all. But when it comes to me, I stick with some colors and then just do those colors. That's it. And then everything goes. So if you see something, you're like, oh, that looks really nice on that Instagram advert that I've seen 10 times now. Oh, I think it's talking to me. Oh, I think it wants me to buy it. And then you click on through and you're like, oh no, it's only available in that color that's not on my colors. Oh, what a shame. Can't have it. Yeah.
I set
hard and fast rules with myself, and that is how I control my ADHD impulsivity. It's just being like, what a shame, Jessica. You've come up against a rule. Oh, no. I also, again, do this with my toddler. I'll be like, oh, you've used up today's 5 raisins. Ah, well, tomorrow's 5 raisins will be available tomorrow. And he's like, okay. Off he goes. Excellent. But I've done this with myself since childhood, so I'm quite practiced.
I love that you, I feel like I have the, I lean more on the oppositional defiance side of ADHD. So if a rule comes up, I'm like, yeah, so I'm going to break that now.
I think it works because I made the rule. I think if someone else had made the rule, I'd be like, I will find a way to bend this. I've never broken it. I just bent it. But if it's my rule, I'm like, oh no, Jessica, you are wise. Good rule, good rule. Okay.
I think they call that malicious compliance when you have rules like in a workplace that you don't want to follow, but then you follow them to the T.
Oh yeah, that was me childhood. That was me. I was like, I am the good one. Well,
someone else commented, love, 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 Jessica. I'm a doctor, though not a psychiatrist, a GP. How can singular ordinary doctors help ADHDers and chronically ill people?
Okay. I think the best advice is to know that GPs are the first line of access. I mean, obviously GPs know this. Hi, GP. You're aware of what your job is. But for us, it can feel very much like, oh God, I really rely on my GP and my GP, but like believing in me, having faith in me, trusting in me in order to access the specialist services. Because I've on a number of occasions experienced having to get over the big hurdle of my GP to get to a specialist, you know, and having to prove over and over and over again to a GP to get to a specialist to then goes, oh yeah, obviously. Wow, you've clearly got this thing. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, good. But it took me 2 years to get this appointment. And the issue can sometimes be that there's a lot of like that red tape and the paperwork and all the things that are put in place, because they obviously don't want everyone going to all of the specialists all the time, because then, you know, for the NHS has a finite amount of money. It would not be possible. But knowing really who your patients are, knowing as a GP, like who the patients are who are trying to express something and are a little bit, can be a little too scared sometimes to fully express themselves or to fully press. Like, I have a lot of medical trauma, and I will struggle to say to my GP, like, oh, no, I really do need this. I really do need this. And instead I'm like, okay, if you could just get round to that form when you can, cool. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. GP. Thank you. I love you. Bye. Which is not helpful for anyone at all, obviously. But it's that kind of awareness that, like, okay, knowing that we have to work with the specialists and just helping people get seen when they can get seen. I don't know. I think there are so many great, amazing GPs out there who are trying their hardest. And then there are some that aren't great. but it's hard to give advice to, like, the really amazing ones, because obviously they're already trying so hard. They're already going above and beyond. And, like, I know in personal life, really great GPs as well. So, like, I know people who are, they work such an unforgiving job and throw themselves into it. So, thank you to all doctors, actually.
So it'd be like, listen to your patients and, yeah, give them the space to bring up the things that they are struggling with.
My grandfather was a doctor, but he was a surgeon, and he used to say that it was only, no matter how long the appointment was, it was only ever in the last 3% of the appointment time that you would find out what the actual problem was. That you'd have a follow-up appointment after the surgery, and you'd be like, how was your surgery? You know, how's it all going? They'd be like, yes, fine. Everything's absolutely fine, doctor. Really going well. Really going great, really going amazing. And then as they were leaving, they'd be like, I mean, there's this one thing. It does seem to be, like, terrible on the inside. Terrible pain all day, every day. And he's like, cool. If we could have had that at the start of the appointment, good. Yeah. Giving space and explaining. Not everyone knows what medical words terms mean at all. Even the words that seem obvious to you, because you've been around them all day, every day for years and years and years while studying.
Yeah. Someone else has asked, how do you get out of feeling stuck when executive function is overwhelming? And then they said, by the way, I've been watching you since I was a teenager, and now I'm married. You've given me hope that a positive future is possible for me as a disabled lesbian.
Goodness. Wow. Well, congratulations. That's so exciting. Wow. Well, you know what? Sometimes you just have to give in. I don't think that pushing against a brick wall will necessarily get you anywhere. I think it is okay to grab maybe an egg timer and give yourself, you know, set 15 minutes on it, 10 minutes, whatever it is you need, and just lie on the floor. And I like to, in these moments, I like to pull out a mobile game, because for me, it's the most passive way of doing. But see, I have this rule with myself where I'll never see rules again. I have this rule where I'll never spend actual money on any kind of mobile game. So there reaches a point where it's like, you can't play anymore unless you pay actual money. And I'm always like, haha, game, I've outsmarted you, I won't. So then I'm like, well, that's me done. I guess okay. So that's what I tend to do in my moment. But I know for a lot of people that can be not the best choice of thing to do in that time. So whatever is your kind of, I'm letting my brain be, I'm letting it go for a moment. I'm not going to keep pushing against this. I'm not going to keep smashing on I'm just going to give myself the grace to have a little period of just, okay, we're doing something I really enjoy, or we're doing something that is very easy, something very mind-numbing. You can sit there and do like 10 minutes of pop-pops. God, I don't know what that's really called. What are those called? I said some pop-pops. The things that you pop. That
Candy Crush?
Plastic.
No.
It's a thing you hold. Like a
toy.
Yeah, that you pop it. Yes, there we go. What's that called?
Pop-its.
Pop-its.
It's called pop-its. I don't know.
Maybe. Sure. Whatever that is. Yeah. Or like a tiny little jigsaw or a brain game that's physical. Anything. Something that you're like, right, here we are. We're just moving a little bit. Going back and forth. Okay. Here we go. We're just having a little moment so that you're just almost resetting your brain. That's what I find works best for me, rather than being like, okay, let's go gung-ho about this, I can do it. And then I'm like, okay, now we survey the kitchen, what to do now.
It kind of gets your brain activated in that passive state, as opposed to trying to, like, you know, get into fifth gear all at once while you're driving, right? You have to go through the other gears first.
Exactly.
Someone else has asked, how do you make peace with all the times you would have struggled with ADHD symptoms growing up but not had the diagnosis yet to help understand your struggles? Do you feel like you need to grieve the pre-diagnosis painful times?
That's a really interesting question, because I guess for me, obviously there is that sense of like, oh God, I feel like I was almost robbed of something, you know, like, oh, I could have done, like I was putting in so much effort into something, and I always knew in primary school, especially, that I was very working above my level and above my year group. In every task, I just wasn't very good at answering questions on a piece of paper. So, you know, throughout the year, I would be taking all of the classes that were for the year above me, or they'd be like bringing me the extra work down to my room and being like, she's run out of stuff to do. She already knows how to do this. Like, I could already read when I was a 2-year-old, because my mother got bored of having to read me so many books to make me go to sleep.
Yeah. So she was, I like, think I was 3 as well.
Books, letters. I was like, brilliant, cool. I shall teach myself to read. Excellent. So I obviously entered primary school already being able to read, and that gave me an advantage that kind of went on and on and on. But every time it came to some kind of grading environment, every time it came to some kind of like, oh, here's a big thing that will mean a thing, I'd be like, oh, this is this is meaningful. Oh, darn. And I could no longer rely on the fact that throughout the year, whenever I'd been given homework or a class thing, and I'd done it in a different way, and my teacher had been like, wow, that's so innovative and interesting. I'd had to do a project on the Roman baths. So I built a 2-scale model miniature of the Roman baths out of mosaic tile when I was 7, which is like the kind of stuff I did as a child. Or for English, I just didn't do any of the homework for English. I instead created this massive portfolio of short stories and poems. And my English teacher just let me sit in the corner of the room and like go wild. Mm-hmm. And no one, I was like, no one prepared me at all for the thought that you then have to go and sit in an exam room. Instead, they were all like, you're just so clever. Wow, you're really good, right? Wow. And they thought I'd be fine. And I went and sat in an exam mm-hmm. room, and someone placed a piece of paper in front of me, and it had a question on it. And I'm not good at reading questions. Instead, I wrote a great essay. I'm sure it was about something else, but it was a great essay. And I was like, here you go. And every time it's like, mm-hmm. that's not what the topic was, Jessica. Mm-hmm. Not at all. Or it would be like, Jessica, it says answer 3 of the 10 questions, and you answered 10 of the 10 questions. And I'm like, oh, but I did them all. So don't I get extra points?
Points? Like,
no, not at all. That's not how that works. Mm-hmm. Oh, darn. This is not good. Mm-hmm. So yes, there's a definite process there that I think, and that's kind of like the light stuff, obviously, mm-hmm. compared to some of the darker childhood things that we don't need to go into. But for me, looking back, I don't necessarily think in a dark way, oh, how awful what I was robbed of. I think, wow, how strong I was. Because I was also dealing with a lot of physical things at the time and struggling being believed about by adults and sort of saying, no, I'm in pain every single day. My body is hurting me every single day. Like this pain I'm trying to describe to you is excruciating. And because I had so many injuries and illnesses, because I'm very prone to illness as well, I started to not be believed to the extent that I had a broken bone on the playground, and it was ignored, and I got sent back to class. I was like, I can't lift my arm. And they were like, oh, again. No, I genuinely can't. And that was not a nice situation for me at all. My arm does not point in the right direction, even now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh.
And now looking back, I actually feel a real warmth and sense of caring and love and strength for that little girl. And I think when we have things like that, when we look at the past, we can separate out the two things. We can separate out the event and we can separate out ourselves. And there is obviously the deep sadness that can be attached to the event and what's going on and whatever, but there can also be a warmth that we feel for ourselves as children, and we can see the strength and the power within ourselves. And in effect, we can be the ones who look back and kind of reach our hand out to them and send the warmth back to them.
That's so sweet.
Through the timeline.
That's like this whole idea of, I guess, kind of reparenting yourself that a lot of us are doing now in our 30s.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, I like to look at it that way because, I found there was definitely a grief period of like, oh, what if my mom is in the natural health care space, so she did not want her child on medication. So, and also gifted in school. So again, didn't struggle with schoolwork. So other things that I was struggling with maybe got overlooked because it was like, well, she's doing fine in school. Looking back and being like, you were doing so well. You were really doing so well with what you had.
Yeah. I mean, I take really strong painkillers now, just to have a daily level of like minor pain. And that's just what I will always have to do because my body is just created and is in such a way that that is how it is. Like it's quite messed up. But I look back and I'm like, I went to school. I only started taking these after school. Oh my goodness me. Like I, wow, as a 15-year-old, was walking around carrying that heavy backpack with all of those massive textbooks. And I remember being in such excruciating pain and barely able to walk. And I'm like, you absolute marvel. You go. Like, wow. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. And I think there's so much healing that we can do for ourselves by thinking of it that way. And by holding that sort of child or adult within us and thinking like, yeah, you know what? I'm here now. And I'm, mm-hmm, even if I'm not fully 100% sorted, I'm a little bit more sorted than you are. Hun, you're not doing so great. So I can lend you some of that. I can give that to you. And in effect, that then comes back around.
So I think we're getting close to probably wanting to finish up with time here. I had one more question. How do you think Claudia helps you with your ADHD? And then on a side note, has she been assessed? Because we tend to attract each other. And some of the videos, when you watch them, you're like, oh, and Claudia just got distracted and da-da-da.
Well, I mean, I can't really speak of my wife's medical situation. But yeah, she's the one who told me to go and get myself a diagnosis and do something about it. And she's also been incredibly helpful with everything. I mean, there are things that we do just as a couple. We just divert to one and the other. And I think that that's a really healthy thing to do, to think in terms of equity rather than things being always equal. And, you know, who's done 50% of the dishes this week? Well, have you done your 50% share? And instead of thinking, well, what can I bring to the table and what can you bring to the table? And what do you not mind doing? What do you enjoy doing? And what are the shortfalls here and who's willing to take those on? She, bless her, finds a lot of comfort and enjoyment in tidying and cleaning. I'm like, okay, you do you. Sure, that's what you want to do. All right. So she very much enjoys doing that, which is excellent, because if she didn't, I would be having a real drama. We also did realize at one point that it was ridiculous for me to be making food, because when she was working full-time as a dentist, I used to make her dinner. And I used to, in fact, make all food. So I'd make her breakfast in the morning and I'd make her lunch whilst I was making breakfast. And then I'd make dinner so it was on the table when she came home, like a great little housewife. And then she would do the food on the day she wasn't working. And she had no idea how long it took me to make the food. And then over lockdown, she was like, what are you doing? Making food. She's like, nobody takes 4 hours to make dinner. I know you don't, but aren't you just really quick? She's like, no, this is ridiculous. What is this? I'm like, I'm just chopping a vegetable. She's like, it's been half an hour. But they're all exactly the same size. No one cares. Apparently they get cooked. I mean, I care, but fine. So now she does all of the food, and that's a really good idea. So things like that work very well for us. And she is in charge of all of my medication, which is also brilliant, because I was constantly running out and being like, oh no, sweetheart, I forgot to tell you for the last 3 days that I was about to run out of this thing, and now I've run out. I just took the last one.
Yeah.
Oh dear. And she's like, oh God, why didn't, if you just told me 3 days ago? And I'm like, I know, I made a mental note to tell you. And then I forgot about it. So, but then when I did remember, I wrote it down on a piece of paper, but it got lost in my pile of 50 other pieces of paper about other important things. She's like, one of these isn't even important. It's just to tell me that you don't like the color of the curtains. Throw that one out.
It's important.
I'm like, that's deeply important. My God. Very. I care. So yeah, very, you know, she handles some of those things that are really great. Mm-hmm. And I'm very good at convincing a toddler to do things. So that's my role. Is in the mornings I'm like, okay, let's get dressed, let's eat some food, let's get ready, all right. And then in the evenings I can convince him to do stuff, and he thinks it's his idea. Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Well, it sounds like you have a great support network in Claudia, and that your parenting and your family life is really actually like working well for you with your ADHD, which is amazing. And it sounds like you're loving being a parent. It's so beautiful to see.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we're getting pretty close to an hour and a half, which is great. Amazing content. Thank you so much for coming on. Where can people find you if they don't know about your content?
Well, you can find me on YouTube, Jessica Calgren-Fozard, which can be quite hard to spell, so don't worry. You can type Jessica out of the closet into the search bar, and I do pop up. It is me. So you can find me on there. You can also find me on Instagram, at Jessica out of the closet, on TikTok, at Jessica out of the closet. No one uses Twitter, but I'm on there. I even call Twitter now. It's like X. That's Jessica OOTC, but it's fine. You can find me on Threads instead, if we're all using Threads now.
Great. And do you have any kind of like last comments that you want to leave our community with?
You know what? I would just say, give yourself some grace and some kindness. Mm-hmm. Your brain is not wired the way other people's are, and really bashing away at it is not going to achieve the same results. So all you should do in this moment is give yourself some love.
Yes, I think a lot of the time that's what so much of what we talk about comes back to, is this self-acceptance, kindness, and just being there, loving yourself.
Yeah, because we can be incredible, amazing people who achieve so much by the standards of the world, but we're going to do it in our own way.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks everyone who's listening. It's been amazing to have you on, Jessica, and everyone who's listening, we love you. Thank you for joining. If you want to rate or review the podcast, we really appreciate that. We have our own Instagram now, which is at ADHD Explorers. You can check us out on Discord as well. We love to hear from you. And thanks everyone again so much for joining. Bye bye bye.
Thanks so much.